The middle class is being priced right out of the housing market this morning. A closer look at that so-called missing middle in real estate and how to get it back. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a good weekend. We are starting you off right at a live broadcast, always live at 9. And make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, what's being done to make housing more affordable on the First Coast? And we want to hear your real estate stories, too. So give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, why we should all try to be a little more patient. That according to a new study from UNF. Plus, Culpepper and a big win for Webb Simpson at the Players Championship. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, we're going to take a closer look at the shrinking middle class and real estate. Now, we've all heard a lot in recent years about spiking income inequality and how that's negatively impacting the economy. It turns out the gap between rich and poor is also having a big effect on real estate and America's housing market. Simply put, home ownership is slipping out of reach for millions of people in this country. It's causing a bigger demand than ever for rental housing, but often rental housing isn't affordable either. Also in demand, homes at the bottom and the top ends of price points on the housing market. So in cities across the country and even around the world, a new trend is emerging in real estate. It's called middle housing. What is that exactly? And what's going on with real estate here in our corner of Florida? We decided to investigate, and we're beginning the hour right now with a closer look as we welcome Melody Schachter. She is with the energy-efficient building company TerraWise Homes. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also on our WJCT Board of Trustees, and also in studio, Mark Sherman, senior loan consultant with Loan Depot in Jacksonville Beach, as we talk about getting mortgages, financing, what's going on there. Good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And this Monday morning, we want you to give us a call. Is home ownership out of reach for you? What have been your struggles with real estate? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We also welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. All right, Melody Schachter, let's begin with you. What we're seeing increasingly in Jacksonville and cities around the country is a big crunch when it comes to affordable housing. People being able to get into homes they can afford. Even rental housing is out of reach for a lot of people these days. So it's incredible to see these numbers. There's been a 7% increase in the percentage of households at the top of the income spectrum, but also about the same increase of households at the bottom of the income spectrum. What about all the people in between? They're being priced out. When you look at how this is playing out in Jacksonville, in particular through the lens of your company, TerraWise Homes, you're a home builder. What are you seeing?
Well, we're seeing an increasingly number of people who are looking for houses in that 175 to 250 range, which is very difficult to find. And that now is really the low end of the spectrum for new homes.
Right. 175 is considered sort of the bottom now, a starter home price.
Starter home, if you can find that. I mean, that
if
is
you can find it.
That is really very rare. I would say the majority of home builders are starting in the 225 would be considered an entry level.
And we'll hear more about what TerraWise is doing in that space in a minute. But first, Mark Sherman, is that what you're seeing in your business too?
Absolutely. We're finding that a lot of people are getting pre-qualified in that 250 and below range, and it takes them oftentimes months to find a property that they can secure.
And what are they telling you, your clients, your customers, when they come to you?
Well, they're telling me that if the house is attractive, if it's that they're getting involved in bidding wars at times, that you have to be ready to move immediately, or you lose the opportunity to buy that home.
549-2937. And so, Melody Schachter, more rental demand. There's downward pressure on home ownership. 35% of working age households are earning less than 2% of the U.S. median income. That's compared to 31% in the year 1970. That means there's this ever shrinking percentage of households who qualify to get into the American dream, a house.
Right, right. And I think you're going to see builders are starting to develop homes, I know we are, that are maybe a little more flexible. So, you know, for example, our smallest home now has the ability to have two masters, which gives you the opportunity to buy a home and maybe rent out another master suite. So you've got some income coming in. We have another house plan that we call a Next Zen, which has a mother-in-law suite built into it. So you can either have your mom or you can have a adult child or whatever live, but have their own space. Mm-hmm. So I think you're starting to see that kind of trend emerge from home builders.
And that's what I wanted to ask you both about, this new concept of what is being called middle housing. It's sort of a middle ground between single family homes and multi-story apartments. That can be the types of home setups that you just described. Mm-hmm. Also brownstones, bungalow courts, clustered housing, maisonettes, row houses, stacked townhomes. There are all sorts of products emerging in the real estate market.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, builders have to look and see what the market is and what do people need and how do we meet that need? I mean, that's ultimately our goal.
Okay. And so when people come to you for financing, Mark, are they asking about these types of options or do you still see that people really want that single family home?
Well, obviously, single family homes lead the market in sales, but lending agencies such as FHA have expanded our criteria to allow people to use other types of income, including border income, you know, to address what Melody said there. So in a case where you do have maybe a mom with Social Security income moving in with you, we can apply her income as well and use that to qualify the buyer.
Okay. And so tell me a little bit about what TerraWise is doing too, because you're building homes that are not only in that affordable range, they're energy efficient.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the some of the research that we did indicated that people who have a difficult time really paying all their bills and meeting their mortgage, when they have that piece of the you know, $100 or $200 a month electric bill removed from that, and they know that this is going to be their mortgage payment every month and they don't worry about an additional energy charge, mm-hmm. It makes it more affordable and it's more sustainable for them. And of course, more sustainable for the community.
And in downtown Jacksonville, we're seeing new buildings go up that are being built as affordable housing, mm-hmm. In the La Villa area in particular, lofts that are an affordable rent for people. Those are hard to come by. Even the rental market is difficult for people in this city and in most cities that make a middle to lower middle class income, it can be really tough to find something within your budget.
Well, absolutely. And you can end up spending a lot more on rent than you could on a mortgage. I mean, if you were to take the average rent, say, if it were $1,300 or $1,400 in town, you could certainly get a mortgage for around $900 to $1,000 for a $150,000 to $175,000 home.
We want your calls as we talk about real estate and affordable housing. Do you think the rent is too damn high? That's the best-selling book title. I haven't had a chance to read that book yet, but I want to. Have you had trouble qualifying for a mortgage? We want your calls at 549-2937. And the state's population is exploding, but this year, Florida will spend less on affordable housing programs than it has in the last 25 years, just as housing costs are going up in most cities. The crunch is getting worse. What are you hearing on the ground as you go around and you talk to people about this? You're so involved in real estate. I'm so curious to hear what you're hearing.
Well, I mean, that is exactly what we're seeing. You know, when we have people that come into our sales offices, the feedback that we're getting from sales counselors is that, you know, people are really looking for houses under that 250,000 range, which was when we started the company was really our goal, was to provide energy efficient housing at sort of that entry level first time buyer move up because mm-hmm. there's just not a lot of that out there.
That's true. And of course, you know, we always encourage people to sit down with a mortgage counselor, as I like to think of it, and find out where you stand. You know, go ahead and do a review of your credit, your income, and make sure you have the assets to move forward. So when that house does become available, because as we said, there is limited inventory, you can move forward confidently.
Yeah, you should be looking. You should do that before you even start looking for a house.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you both your thoughts on something else. We carry the public radio program Reveal. It's from the Center for Investigative Reporting. They recently aired a landmark series investigation looking at how not only is getting a mortgage hard for millions of Americans, Caucasian Americans, They surveyed large data sets around the country and found that 50 years after the Federal Fair Housing Act banned racial discrimination in lending, African Americans and Latinos continue to be routinely denied conventional mortgage loans at rates higher than their white counterparts, so a sort of a modern day form of redlining. And the study found this happened even when they controlled for the applicant's income, loan amount, and neighborhood. And so the housing crunch, according to this data set anyway, is even tougher if you're a person of color.
I heard that that revealed program, and I just was heartbroken over it. What a terrible! I mean, how do you even respond to that? It was just not okay.
Well, you know, that actually started the conversation that I had with Melissa. You know, I've been in this industry since 1989, and I've never once seen that happen. I've never had someone come to me and say, "Hey, we're going to decline this loan because of ethnicity or religious, lean." It's a business that goes completely by numbers. It is completely colorblind. If you have the credit, you have the income and the assets, there's no reason you can't get a loan. And I think it also helps to remember that the people in this industry, you know, we work on commission. So there would be really no reason to decline a loan if it's approvable.
What are your thoughts, though, about implicit bias? Because people do genuinely believe that they're colorblind when they're dealing with someone in a business setting, but the data sets reveal something totally different. Like, large nationwide data sets do find implicit bias shows up time and time again, not just in terms of mortgage applications, but in a whole range of situations. It's not something we're conscious of. It's something that's hidden. And it comes out in the numbers.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I mean, I've thought about that quite a few times since hearing that story. And I believe it's more of a socioeconomic challenge. You know, if you don't use a bank regularly, if you don't build and develop credit, you're automatically excluded from the lending process because you have no history. So it's very hard.
But this study controlled for income, loan amount, neighborhood. It controlled for every factor like that and still found people were denied.
You know, every loan application is a specific set of challenges, right? So if someone comes to you with low credit, then, you know, there are some things that can be done to address that. If they don't have the income, that's hard to overcome. So, you know, it helps, once again, to have a conversation up front way before you start the process to see where you stand. And I've never known a loan officer who isn't willing to sit down with their customer and address those issues.
I think it's important, and that speaks to why it's important to have a diverse group of people that you work with. You know, sometimes we don't see something that someone with another ethnicity would see. So diversity, I think, is really the key to addressing that kind of issue.
And let's go to some calls right now. We are talking real estate this Monday on the show. What are your real estate stories? Maybe what are your real estate horror stories? We want to hear them as we talk about the affordable housing crunch, the new trend of middle housing. Have you been priced out of both rental housing or a home, or are you trying to buy or sell a home? Give us a call, 549-2937. Kate is on the north side. Hi, Kate. Good morning.
Hey, so the craziest thing is happening in my neighborhood. These rental companies are coming in and purchasing all these houses before they can even go on the market. They're in within like the 180 to 220 range. My husband and I put our house on the market. We didn't even end up putting our house on the market because the investment company called us before we put the house on the market, made us a reasonable offer, and now they're renting the house, as they're doing with multiple houses within our neighborhood.
Kate, thanks for that. Mark.
Well, you know, especially after the housing collapse back in 2007, 2008, we saw some hedge funds come down and buy up properties, you know, with cash and turn around and make a significant rental income on them. So I think that still exists out there in the market at that entry level. If you have the means to, say, buy 10 units in a neighborhood, you have and your overhead is less than you can collect in rent, then why not do that? And I think we see a lot of that.
Yeah, we are. And I think another issue, too, honestly, is Airbnb. I don't know if it's an issue here, but my son just sold his house in Denver to someone who was purchasing it to use for an Airbnb.
You know, the Airbnb thing is fascinating. Mm-hmm. That has become a really interesting window into what's going on in real estate around this country. And in Springfield in particular, that's the neighborhood where you're building a lot of Terrorwise homes. There's a thriving Airbnb business going on there, well, isn't there?
It's a cool neighborhood.
Yeah, people want to stay there. 549-2937. Robert is in St. Augustine. Hi, Robert.
Good morning. I'm in the business of developing prototypes that address the affordable housing issue. And one of the things, and probably what I think is one of the most important things to recognize, is that the demographic is changing as people are moving into Florida. I think the idea that the standard equation of three bedrooms, two baths is about to become, aside from the existing housing stock, really a size that's of much lesser need than two-bedroom and even one-bedroom houses. The problem is twofold. One is when you get into to doing micro-housing, which can really fill a lot of people's needs in terms of cost and in terms of what they actually need for size, is banks don't want to recognize them in terms of their lending practices. The second thing, which is as important in facilitating the growth of real affordable housing, is that zoning needs to start to recognize, and the various regions needs to start recognizing the complete groundwork that's necessary for them, for these kind of things to occur. In St. Augustine, they've recently changed the impact fee structure. They raised the impact fee for anything under 1,800 square feet from 9,500 to 11,500. But they also established a new impact fee, which is for 800 square feet or less, which to me is very interesting in terms of the jurisdiction recognizing the need for smaller housing. However, they're not following through as of yet and saying, okay, well, with an 800 square foot house, you don't need as much of a lot to build on. They're still mandating the standard 50 by 150 foot size lot for such a small house, which is unnecessary. They need to start looking at the complete picture in order to facilitate these things to happen. So both the banks and the regional jurisdiction, the building jurisdiction, need to come together and start to recognize that this is a real need and smaller housing is the answer. That's all I'd say.
Okay, thanks for that. Your thoughts, both of you.
Well, I would first dispel the notion that banks make the decision. I mean, everything that a bank or a direct lender or a mortgage broker offers, all the underwriting guidelines are determined by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or VA and FHA. So banks are just following those lending guidelines. We do lending for small condominiums and for other types of property. So I don't think there would be that much of a challenge to find products to accommodate those buyers.
Melody Schachter.
I would say zoning would be the place to start. I certainly agree with the caller that this is all driven by zoning and how the government decides that that a city is going to be laid out and how it's going to be zoned. So attacking the zoning issue is really the key, I think, here, because the banks will then follow.
549-2937. Mark is in St. Augustine. Hey, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I guess your conversation kind of centers around the lack of available housing as it relates to new construction, but I'm curious about the inventory of, say, middle-class homes in neighborhoods that are already established, neighborhoods that might have been considered middle-class to upper-middle-class as relatively recently as, say, 15 or 20 years ago. It's a question of individual priorities where we as a society always want to have the better amenities, the newer house and all that. Or is there an equal push for folks that maybe can afford $125,000 house? They could pick up a house that's in an older St. Nicholas area, area around Inglewood, or even off the State Road 16 in St. Augustine. So I was just curious about your perspective on existing homes and middle-class affordability of those.
Sure. Thanks for that.
Well, you know, our industry is always stands ready to assist in financing any kind of property. What we have seen in our market and what our company does is we are a large renovation lender. So we've seen a uptick in renovation applications, which allow people to move into a home that needs some work, do the appraisal subject to the value of the home with the improvements, and then proceed from there.
Let's go to some of your tweets and Facebook comments as we talk about the housing crunch in this country and in this city. Siobhan writes on our Facebook page, how is affordable housing calculated? When subsidies are given by the city, state, or federal government, what are the affordable housing requirements? Good question.
Good question.
And I think it has to do with the formula, Siobhan, based on your income and the price of the rental or real estate unit. And it's a sliding scale. It probably varies from city to city. Josh writes on Facebook, what amount of the city's needs for affordable housing are currently being met? I think the short answer to that is the new units that are being built are a drop in the bucket when you look at the need out there.
I think so. And one of the challenges, too, is, you know, one of the previous Facebook posts was about sort of picking up infill and houses in, you know, Murray Hill and Springfield and places like that, which is, you know, which is a great, if you're willing to invest the sweat equity into it, it's a great way to get into a house. But you do need to be concerned about a few things. Oftentimes, houses will have liens against them, especially if it's a foreclosure or something like that. The city may have nuisance liens, which could sometimes run into the hundreds of thousands. You know, someone might think they've picked up a great deal at a tax deed sale, only to find out it's got $150,000 worth of liens that now they've got to negotiate with the city. So there's some, you know, there's definitely some issues with what I would call infill that are some opportunities, but you really need to know what you're doing.
What advice would you give to someone who's looking at that?
Gosh, really, you need to really dive in. I would get with a good realtor who is familiar with infill and start talking to them about what some of the issues are. You know, find out about what kind of liens and how does the city address those. You know, you need to know about tree mitigation. There's, of course, the whole infrastructure. You know, we build in Springfield, and certainly with JEA, the infrastructure is already there. But you've got to pay $6,000 to hook up your water sewer. And maybe if there wasn't a house there before, it could be as much as $15,000. So lots of things to think about when you're, you know, looking at picking up something already in the city.
Lee tweets the show, implicit bias is alive and well in Jacksonville. I had difficulty purchasing my last home. I have a 730 credit score and I own a downtown condo outright and VA backed. The lender made the process difficult with unnecessary questions and delays. Thanks for that tweet. And meanwhile, let me ask you both a bigger question. When we had the first house, when we had the housing crash 10 plus years ago, we had a housing glut. Now we have the opposite situation, a housing shortage. And so there has been some chatter in the financial trades and in the real estate press about potentially that we're in another bubble, that a different kind of bubble that could once again burst. Do either of you have concerns about that, about another big valley when it comes to our economy and the real estate piece of it?
Well, you know, when prices are overheated, obviously that's something to be concerned about. Once again, you know, to answer your listener's text or email, you do have to sit down with a lender before you start the process. You can avoid those kind of, issues. Banks do often add overlays to the agency's standard underwriting guidelines. These are self-imposed guidelines that they determine to use to kind of protect the kind of loans they do. But they are applied equally across the board.
Melody?
You know, it's...
Do you worry about another housing bubble and another bubble bursting, another downturn?
We haven't seen that yet. People are looking for lower priced housing, that's for sure. But we haven't seen the run on it that we saw back in 2002, where banks were lending money without really even checking to see if people had jobs, and there was a lot of things that were going on that was creating this kind of bubble. We just don't see that now. Banks are very conservative about what they're lending. They're making sure that people can afford it, and we just haven't. You know, we've seen a nice steady growth.
Let me ask you as well, when you look at the space you work in at Terrawise Homes, there's an increased demand for energy efficient homes, what they call net zero homes. You offer a 20% discount on solar panels for the homes you build, and that can be used in conjunction with a 30% tax credit from the federal government. You put in a lot of energy efficient appliances and techniques, low energy HVAC systems and water heaters. How big a piece of the market are you seeing is this area where people are really increasingly demanding these features in their homes?
You know, I think it's still a very small part of the market. People really just want to get into a house, and they're not necessarily thinking about the long-term costs of that, not realizing that over the cost of their loan, they could maybe save, you know, $50,000 or $75,000 if they didn't have the energy costs. So I think we're still seeing people who are looking at immediate gratification
needs. Okay, right. So yeah, immediate. They need housing,
And they just need to get in.
So what are your final pieces of advice then for people out there who are looking to sell, looking to buy, looking to get financing?
Well, you know, just like I keep beating the drum, but just, you know, sit down with an experienced loan officer and just, you know, review all your options. And if you're not quite ready, take the time to invest in the process. You know, make sure your credit's up to speed, make sure that you have the income, and be realistic about what you can afford.
Mark Sherman is a senior loan consultant with Loan Depot in Jacks Beach. Melody Schachter is with Terrawise Homes, also on our board here at WJCT. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
My pleasure.
Much more still ahead. Later, Cole Pepper has a look back at all the action from the Players. The last time, it's going to be in May. But up next, the rewards of patience. A new UNF study explained. Be patient. We'll have details in just a moment.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
85% of WJCT listeners choose to purchase environmentally friendly and sustainably sourced products to use for their home and businesses. Learn more about marketing opportunities to reach this highly desirable audience at 358-6367.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app, Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Welcome back. Well, here's a question for you. If you're stuck in a long line at the grocery store and someone in front of you is taking forever to pay, or maybe you're waiting for your teenager to get ready to leave the house in the morning for school, or maybe you get annoyed when a meeting at work doesn't start on time because that one colleague of yours is always late, well, how do you react? Are you patient and calm, or do you maybe tap your foot, look at your watch, roll your eyes, sigh? Yeah. Patience is a virtue, it's said, but one that's hard for many of us to master. A new study, though, says patience in our everyday lives is a strong predictor of health and well-being. Dr. Dominic Guess, a UNF psychology professor, conducted a study in Europe looking at patience in everyday life, and he found there are cultural differences when it comes to when people get impatient and also the reactions they show. Dr. Dominic Guess joins us in studio now with more. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. When do you get most impatient? What really makes you lose patience? Give us a call at 549-2937. For me, it's in the morning when my kid's doctor will not get out the door on time. I lose my patience time and time again. And I know I shouldn't, but I do. So when I read this study that you conducted, I was really interested because patience is not one of my virtues. And I think it's probably not one of the virtues for millions of Americans. We tend to be kind of a quick pace population. But you actually conducted this study in Europe, and you looked at the differences in how people react in situations between European countries. What motivated you to go over to, for example, Germany and France to see how they deal with impatience?
Mm-hmm. I was for 1 year in Germany on a fellowship of the European Union, and I thought that would be an interesting study to conduct because I myself know that I easily get impatient. And so we wanted to study in daily life situations, in exactly such situations, how patient people are. And we studied it in three situations. One was a grocery line where we had students intentionally prolong the process of paying. Mm-hmm. And then the other students observed how the people react in line. And the other situation was at an ATM machine. We always waited until four people line up, and then the students observed and measured how long does it take until people showed the first impatience reactions.
Sure. And you found different countries had different results. What were the differences?
Yes. For example, in the ATM situation, it was a little bit surprising that the Germans were the most patient ones. Hmm. And the French and the Romanians more often left simply the line and went somewhere else. And the French more often showed angry facial expressions at the ATM machine.
The French were more likely to express their frustration than the Germans.
Yes, but in the supermarket situation, the Germans were more likely to express their frustration and anger.
So why are the Germans self-controlled at the ATM but not at the checkout line at the grocery store?
Well, one possible explanation is that at the ATM machine, you might attribute the waiting for problems with the technology. Something might be broken there. The card might not be easily read by the machine. But in the grocery situation, they see that the people drop the coins in Europe. They still pay with bills and coins. Mm-hmm. And they see that they paid wrongly. So they were not very patient with clumsy human behavior.
How is that it? Okay. So they were more forgiving of a machine not working, but very judgmental of a human not being efficient.
Yes, yes.
Is that a bit of a window into the German psyche, I guess?
A little bit, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you also found that in countries like France and Germany, it's common to express anger publicly.
Exactly.
Maybe in a way we might not find as acceptable over here in America.
Yes. I think that's important. For example, if someone of us travels to Germany or France and then sees people expressing anger in public, it's more allowed and it's culturally acceptable to show anger and to express anger. And you're right, my impression is that here in the US people are more cautious and not willing to express anger publicly.
Yeah, if you do that, people tend to be a little almost frightened. That's very off-putting in this country. Okay, so as we talk about patience and the importance of patience, the findings of this study are, whether you are from this country or a European country, the more you can cultivate patience, the better off you are. Why is that?
Yes, we know from research that that impatience is related to affects our health. And we know that people who are more patient overall have higher scores in well-being and higher and better health. And we know that probably from ourselves when we are waiting in line or in the post office, it's December and the line is not moving and I'm getting more tense. I have this list of things to do. I have to pick up my kids and I'm worried. I'm getting more tense. And it would be okay to say, wait a minute, stop these thoughts, calm down. It's just 1 or 2 minutes. Everybody has to wait. In the long term, it doesn't really matter as much. And if you calm down and relax, it's in the long run, much better for
you. Sometimes easier said than done, right? But we will talk about some techniques to become more patient in a moment. First, though, let's go to your calls. When do you become most impatient? 549-2937. Chet is in St. John's County. Hi, Chet. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. My biggest issue with patients is when someone insists on doing all of the talking and are unwilling to listen to what other people have to say.
Right. When someone just talks right over you. How do you react to that?
Well, you try and get your, what you're trying to say, you try and make it clear. And, you know, if they're insisting on listening to what they have to say and not what you or others have to say, it's very difficult to deal with that. Just at sometimes just get up and walk away because, you know, if you're trying to make a point and they're not willing to listen, what else are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. Doctor.
That's a good point and an important point. And we know this from many meetings. And the caller mentioned just walk away. And that's a good strategy. But oftentimes in our work environment, we cannot simply walk away.
Right. Especially if you have to meet with someone regularly at work who tries your patience. Mm-hmm. There are millions of people that can relate to that.
Yes. And one way is perhaps to try to intervene and interrupt gently, involve others in the discussion, but that might not always work. And then the other option is to reprogram ourselves to try to say, wait a minute, let them talk. Sooner or later, they will stop.
Hopefully. 549-2937. Gordon has been holding patiently. Hey, Gordon, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Question is, when are you going to run for Congress? You have interviews with every kind of politician, every kind of topic. You've gone through it for years. You know it cold. You're not afraid to talk. You're not afraid to take people on. You're a woman, which is a plus in this age. Why not run?
You know what, Gordon? I don't have the patience. But
that's
I really appreciate, it's a money raising game more than any of the other things you mentioned, unfortunately, in this
and
day and age.
That's the reason I'd like to see you do it. We've got to get rid of the money.
Well, you won't get an argument from me on that one. But thanks for saying all that. By the way, while we have you on the line, what tries your patience the most?
Congress. And one particular guy at the head of the group, but I won't get into that.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call. You know, I think his comments reflect just Americans aren't a patient lot. We're angry at our politicians. We're angry at the big banks. We just had a segment on the show about housing. Mm-hmm. We're angry at each other. We're angry at our neighbors, our own family members, because the country's so divided right now. Mm-hmm. And I know your study looked at Europe, how people in European countries try to become more patient or not. But what are your observations about Americans when it comes to this issue of patience?
I think sometimes people have common sense and have ideas why is this problem not solved simply that way? And why does it take politicians so long? And that makes us impatient. And that's a problem not only in the US, but in many other countries, that common sense is not everything, apparently, in Washington or in Berlin or in Paris. There are many other things that drive political decisions, unfortunately.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You look at it from a distance out in the middle of the country and say, why can't they just use common sense and solve these problems? Mm-hmm. And there's just an enormous frustration and anger when at least voters perceive that that is not being done. And so our politics are an example of this. But culturally, like say you're out at the grocery store or say you're in traffic. Mm-hmm. People don't have a lot of patience with each other. I've noticed a big change since I was a kid, really, in this country in terms of how we interact with each other in daily life.
And unfortunately, it can escalate. I mean, we know in the streets you have these situations of road rage where it's people are already tense, perhaps from work or from a family situation. And then just a small last thing that happens in traffic, that someone is passing me and then stepping on the brake, and then a situation can escalate. But exactly in such situations, this aspect of self-regulation, of controlling our own emotions, it would be very important. But it's easier said than done. Mm-hmm.
Now, when we lose control of our patients, not only does our heart rate go up, our muscles get tense, our blood pressure goes up, we're physically harming our bodies, but we're also damaging relationships with people around us. So cultivating patience is good for our health. It's good for our loved ones' health. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, as you were talking, you can actually practice patience. I looked this up. Mm-hmm. If you are impatient, you're perceived as arrogant, insensitive, impulsive. You're seen as just being someone with poor people skills. And so this is something that we all need to work on. I do too, frankly. I've gotten a lot better as I've gotten older, but we could all do better. Mm-hmm. So if you find yourself with shallow breathing, clenched hands, restless feet, all of those physical triggers, you need to think about that and use some tips to cultivate more patience. As you mentioned, mm-hmm. Doctor, taking some deep, slow breaths and counting to 10 is the simplest way. Mm-hmm. What else can people do?
And sometimes stopping our own thoughts, if we see we are going down that line, oh, this is the list I have to do, the kids, I'm going back to that. But to say, wait a minute, stop these thoughts and think of something else. And, think of an, for me, for example, think of the beach and the waves. That's an mm-hmm. image that calms me down right away.
Do you live on the ocean?
I wish I could afford it. Back to the housing
back
situation.
To housing. It all ties together. Okay, how about this one? Practice active listening and empathic listening, which is easier said than done. Make sure you give other people your full attention and wait to respond until you've really processed what they have to say. I think that's something that it's an important skill. It's easier said than done. It takes practice.
Yes, and that's very important. Even, I think, another study about life happiness, the ability to listen to other people, to have deep relationships, is one of the strongest predictors of life happiness. Mm-hmm.
And if you find yourself getting in these situations commonly, like all the time, rather than just once in a while, that could be an anger management problem, which is a whole different conversation. But it's really fascinating to hear from you on this study. Are you planning to do any more work with it?
Yeah, I would like to replicate some parts of it in the U.S. and perhaps in rural areas and in cities. And I could imagine that there
are differences. Difference there? Mm-hmm. I'd love to see that too. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great study out of UNF on patients from psychology professor Dr. Dominic Guess. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, we'll go to Culpeper for a look back at the Players' Championship. We played.
Oh, I'm never breaking. Just a little patience. Yeah.
Hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
WJCT listeners and viewers enjoy and support cultural events and activities. Many attend gallery openings, concerts, festivals, and art exhibits in Jacksonville and surrounding areas. Learn how to reach this audience by calling 358-6367.
The humanitarian and military crisis in Syria can be hard to see clearly, but Marwan Hisham has another way. He's kept an illustrated memoir of the war that is destroying his country and his former hometown, Raqqa. It's a moving rebuke of the complacency he sees from others. Marwan Hisham and artist Molly Crabapple, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, the life and death of Robin Williams. We talk with New York Times culture reporter David Itzkoff, who's written a new biography of the comic and actor. And we speak with Kristen Ritter, star of the Netflix show Jessica Jones, which has been renewed for a third season. She also played Jesse Pinkman's girlfriend in Breaking Bad. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hundreds of dugout canoes have been discovered in Florida, some created as long as 7,000 years ago. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll explore canoe archaeology. We'll discuss a collection of early 20th century newsletters published by the Episcopal Church and talk about the Veterans Legacy Program in Bushnell. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the final installment of The Players in May. Well, it's in the books.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper's here now with a look back at all the action from Sawgrass. You were out there most days last week. What a beautiful week it was, by the way.
Yeah, most days only included Monday through Sunday. So,
oh, man. That,
but it is. It's one of my favorite months, weeks of the year. And again this year, just a fantastic experience out there. I want to give a quick hat tip to all the volunteers.
Yeah.
Over 2,000 volunteers,
coats.
The mm-hmm. Redcoats, everybody who organizes that, the tour staff, the whole bit. Just a great event. I was out there on Saturday with some folks who had never been to the tournament before. And the reaction that first timers give when they don't really know what to expect and they see everything that's going on out there and they watch the golf a little and they watch everything else a lot.
Yeah.
It's really more than just a golf tournament. They do a great job putting it on. And I think in many ways, because as you mentioned, this is the last time they'll play in the month of May, it will be a memorable one for a number of different reasons, not the least of which being the performance of the winner, Webb Simpson, mm-hmm. who was just tremendous, tied for the lead in the opening round and then never had anybody follow him as he led throughout the rest of the week, tied the course record in the process and wound up winning yesterday, 18 under par. At one point, he was at 20 under, and also there have only been two golfers who have ever finished with a score of 20 under par or better at the Players, and they happened to do that in the same year, Greg Norman and Fuzzy Zeller. But the way that Simpson was playing was just tremendous, and what he has overcome is really remarkable. Here's a guy who won the U.S. Open in 2012, and in 2013, he won on the tour and hadn't won since. His putting had just lost him. And last year at this time at the Players, he got some advice from Tim Clark, a former Players champion, about his putting. And it's been this year-long process to fix his putting. And his putter was just on fire over the weekend. And he played so well. And his caddy, Paul Tesori, is a First Coast guy. Went to St. Augustine High School, grew up playing in the courses around the area. It says he's probably played 700 rounds at the TPC Sawgrass. And so for Simpson to win in that way was certainly gratifying for both he and his caddy.
This is his favorite tournament. Include every tournament, this is his favorite tournament. And it's one of my favorite. I mean, it's the greatest field in golf. So to be able to come out in front of his friends and family, and a tournament that has always meant something to him. He grew up here. This one was sweet to share with him.
There had to be a point in these last several years as you were battling back that you had some doubts about whether you could win a tournament of this stature. When did you think winning this tournament was a reality?
I felt like after I got a few months under my belt of really consistent play, I really believed that I could win big tournaments again. And I didn't care which tournament. I just wanted to win a tournament. So to make my – it feels like, my first victory, because it's been so while. It's been since 2013. So it feels great that it's the Players. So couldn't be happier.
We mentioned his caddy, Paul Tesori, from St. Augustine. His grandfather was the starter at the Ponte Vedra Inn and Club.
Oh, really?
And Tesori attended the first Players Championship that was played in Jacksonville That's going back to the 70s. So, wow. You know, 41 years ago, he went to his first golf tournament, and that was the one. And now here he is on the bag of the winner. He was getting as much love around the course as Simpson was.
Huh. The one thing that we're taught by our psychologist is nothing changes. It does not matter if you're out, so nothing changes. And he believes in off time. So it's hard when you're going that deep to truly believe in off time. But in between, I was going through my Rolodex of things to say. We're talking about the house at home, maybe building an addition, talked about the kids. They have a bunch of birthdays right now. I went into basketball, and there was none last night, so that kind of stunk. I didn't have anything to talk about there. But I was just trying to find new and better things to talk about as we went along. And that's why it must have been hard for Steve Williams and Bones all those years. They were in contention every week. But it was pretty good. Webb was doing a great job in between shots, just trying to keep his mind off of what was happening.
And that was DeSori after Simpson tied the course record, referring to Tiger Woods' former caddies, who always had to find a way to deal with what he was dealing with during the week. And Tiger's resurgence was another story. Barely made the cut, and then at one point, the only guy ahead of him on the leaderboard was Webb Simpson. So I think Tiger's getting himself in a position where he can win a tournament again.
Uh-huh.
And again, as we mentioned, this is the last year in May. It'll be moving back to March next year, which was its original month. It'll be a little bit earlier in the month.
How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, it'll end on St. Patrick's Day. So I guess instead of a pink out, we'll have a green out next year. Mm-hmm. The course will play more difficult because the weather is likely to play a bigger role. I really like it in May for a couple of reasons.
Gorgeous.
It's a little warm if you don't keep an eye on the shade and the hydration, but one of the things that happened when I was covering this tournament in March, folks would come from the, you know, the golf community, and everybody would be thinking about the Masters, the next, the first major. And it was only a couple weeks later. Now there'll be about a 4 week gap between the players and the Masters. So hopefully that will alleviate that. But since it moved to May, the players has really risen in status, in stature, in prestige. Mm-hmm. And I hope it remains on that trajectory. Mm-hmm. A lot of the young golfers, guys in their 20s and early 30s we talked to this week, were all of, you know, basically said this is a major. And that's been one of the, you know, the fifth major conversation that kind of went away for a while, but they really think about that along the way. I do think you're going to see more sweaters and fewer sundresses when the when the tournament goes to March, because we know the weather can be more volatile in March than it is in May.
And Jaguars held their rookie mini camp over the weekend. That's one final sports note. Always good to talk to you, Cole. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for more, and catch him on Channel 4. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 as well. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.